from the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. Science Pope. I like putting those two together.
Science and Pope.
Yes.
Science and religion?
Yes.
Is that the...
Yes. So today we're going to be talking about science and science standards. And kind of as a warm-up, I wanted to know, like, do you have a great memory or story about learning science?
A great memory or story about learning science. I'll tell you which pops kind of into my brain is the smell of formaldehyde. Okay. I don't know. I'll tell you why. Because I don't know if they even still do these anymore. We used to do dissections of animals. It was disgusting.
Like how big of an animal?
Like we did. I have a memory of a cat. That's probably totally illegal. Yes, a cat. We did frogs. We did a cow's eye. Like, maybe this was the thing when you taught science 30 some odd years ago.
So do you think you, 40? Like, remember this better than if it were an earthworm? Like, is it just, I'm cutting a cat. Oh, my God. I'm going to remember everything.
I really remember the smell and that kind of feeling of, ugh, you know, just, ugh. And I liked science. I really did. I really enjoyed biology, except for the dissections. And I took physics, I took chemistry. I liked science a lot. And then I just never went into it.
It's because you went to college and you discovered there were things besides science, math, and English.
I think so.
You discovered there's like Greek literature or something like that.
Russian literature, that's what I got into, for sure. So what about you? What's your memory?
So it's funny. You know, I all my memories of science are generally out of the classroom. I used to read books, biographies of great scientists that are like written for kids.
Aww.
And then I remember doing a science project for my son. It was like about pulleys and things. And
Wait, you said doing the project for your son?
Maybe.
Okay, you've just outed.
Yeah, so I really got outed because he was too young, and so the pulleys, how they worked, he couldn't understand.
Oh my gosh.
And so I'm trying to say, when they come around to ask you what's going on, say this, and he's like, I don't know.
The prep didn't work for that.
But my strongest memories of science classroom is actually a college physics class I took. Hmm. Where the professor was intensely shy, just incredibly shy. And so the rooms and the light in the auditorium was kept incredibly low. And then she would stay facing the chalkboard and would lecture facing the chalkboard. And
that is not good.
No, it wasn't. I remember at one point, about the eighth weekend, there was a letter that came from the dean that was to all the students in that class and said, look, we'll find a way to get you through that class. Just come back.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember that. It's not exactly a science-centered memory, but I remember that.
Right. Wow. Well, when you just said that, I took, because I was an English major, I took chemistry for poets. And actually, it was a great class. We made, I think I've said this before, we made nylons. Like a nylon that you wear
like
on
like the thread.
Yeah.
Or
we made it
full...
from nothing. Like it was just, boom, it was magic to me.
Wow. So we have the right guest.
Yes.
It's not obvious to me that making nylon counts as science. Although it sounds awesome. I mean, it sounds
totally
this tiny, thin filament coming out of goo.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
This is so cool. So we're excited to have Jonathan Osborne here. He is a professor of science education emeritus at Stanford Graduate School of Education. And he is actually responsible for many of the changes in how kids learn science today because he's an author of the Next Generation Science Standards.
Let me also add that Jonathan taught science in the K-12 space, and he was a scientist.
So he's the best person to answer all these questions.
He's perfect.
Okay, I'm excited.
Thank you for being perfect, Jonathan.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Welcome, thanks, great.
So here's my question. I know there's these things called the Next Generation Science Standards. I didn't even know there was the First Generation Science Standards. I think a lot of people are probably in the same boat as me. So kind of walk us through. I know that a standard helps you. It's a guide for teaching science. But was there an old set? How are these new?
There was a previous set, which was called the National Science Education Standards, which were written in 1996, and they were voluntary. And so, you know, what's changed? That was only, you know, say less than 20 years ago. So why do they need to write the new ones? And the answer to that really is because there's kind of been a shift, I think, in terms of people's expectations. The previous standards were defined very much in terms of what kids should know and understand at the end, whereas the new standards are defined in terms of what students should be able to do with that knowledge. So they're measured by their performance rather than just what they know and understand. So that's one of the big changes. The other thing was the other standards were written in a rather kind of vague way, so they were interpreted in different ways by different people, and what they meant was sometimes not picked up in the way you thought it should be. So there's a lot of emphasis on teaching science through inquiry, but what teaching science through inquiry meant different thing to you that it might mean to somebody else in that kind of way. Basically it got boiled down to the kind of idea, well, teaching science is hands-on, you know, well, a bit like your conversation, you're remembering things about formaldehyde and nylon.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is, you know, these are great experiences. These are the kinds of things that we do remember. But fundamentally, in the end, I kind of argue that really science is about sort of ideas. And they're often kind of like difficult ideas. You know, even the simple idea for most kids that we live on a sphere rather than, okay, on a flat plane. It's pretty difficult to accept because, after all, why don't the people in Australia fall off?
Right. Why don't the people in Australia fall off?
Why don't the people in the U.S. fall off?
So basically, they've shifted towards measuring what students can do and defining those in terms of a whole set of practices. Okay, so being able to analyze and interpret data, being able to construct an explanation, being able to argue from evidence, okay, being able to develop a model. Okay, so these are, if you look at what they're expected to do, it's much more demanding in some kinds of ways.
Interesting. So, and is it still broken up into chemistry and biology and physics, or not even that?
It's broken up into life sciences, okay, which includes a kind of a lot of environmental aspects, physical sciences, which is physics and chemistry, as you and I knew, and earth sciences, which includes a lot of stuff to do with astronomy and our place in the universe and things like that.
So the shift away from this is what you should know to sort of this is how you should go about knowing seems very important. Were there principles around this? Is it like we want all students to be junior scientists, or we want all students to be consumers of science, or this is just beautiful knowledge and people should partake of beauty? Were there some principles that helped you determine, or it's like the English department, where basically it's a fist fight. Shakespeare should be in the curriculum. No, Dante should be in the curriculum.
He wants to know, was it dirty?
It was dirty in some senses. I think the broad principle is that this should be what's an educated person should know by science by the time they leave high school, okay? On the assumption that they're not necessarily going on to science. But at the same time, every scientist wants their bit of their science on the curriculum. So the earth scientists produced this long list of stuff that should had to be in, okay, which would have taken up the whole curriculum in its own right.
I can see it. Yeah. Ninth grade, fracking.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Jonathan Osborne about how he helped to create the next generation science standards and how everybody wanted their own piece of science in there. And you only have 4 years, right? Or is this K-12?
This is K-12.
So but you have 12 years.
You do the back of the envelope calculation, and I reckon that's about 1,500 hours, okay? And you try and think, okay, could you learn all of those sciences and learn those kinds of abilities to like analyze, interpret data in that period of time? And it's a pretty demanding stretch.
Wow.
It's not a lot of time. It seems but it's not.
So you punted a little bit on my question. Yeah. You said that the guiding principle was this is what an educated student should know.
Yeah.
That seems a little circular to me. So what was there a principle, was there a shift to say students need to experience the process of science? And that was kind of a new principle as opposed to just knowing the facts of the matter?
I think that that principle about the process of science was always there through the emphasis on teaching through inquiry. It just wasn't so explicit. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. What we did in the chapter I was responsible for writing was to try and say, what does that actually mean? It means that you should have opportunities to construct an argument from evidence, because basically science is an evidence-based belief system in that sense. You should have an opportunity to develop a model. So it's made it more explicit, and there's a way in which it's left it less open to interpretation, so that hopefully there will be more consistency in what students get from K to 12.
I mean, I think the way I see it is, I could, you know, look at the nylon example. Yeah. I could not tell you what the formula was. I can't tell you anything about sort of just that it was super cool to pull the string out of goo.
But you will vote to invest more money into science because of that. There's the goal.
As a citizen, right, I think I see and appreciate the value of people learning science. That is true. That's a good outcome. But to Jonathan's point, you know, if you asked me to analyze what happened or come up with sort of the evidence of what makes this, you know, nylon and what makes this not nylon or something like that, no way.
No, that's the hard bit, which is difficult to remember. Okay, and you chat to a lot of your, you know, people and say, what do you remember from school science? And it's likely to be always in terms of a phenomena. There was this really cool experiment, okay? And that's a little bit worrying, really, because, yes, the phenomena are great, but if you don't have the ideas to explain them, okay, you know, just take the idea of day and night caused by a spinning Earth. You know, it's patently, you know, well, why should we believe that? It's patently obvious. The sun rose in the east, set in the west, the sun moves. Okay, so how are you going to convince somebody, okay, that it's the, not, the sun's not moving, we are?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really hard job. You have thousands of hours, but you also, I think, so talk to me about the teacher training that goes on here, because I think there's a lot of, I'm just thinking elementary school teachers particularly, they're not necessarily trained in this, and now you're asking them to really start teaching science in a way that isn't just open up the book and read this chapter.
No, and that's quite demanding, okay, and it does take a lot of teacher training. And it's a, I mean, this document that led to the change in standards was written, I think, in 2012. Standards changed in 2013, and here we are in 2019. And it's a long-term process, okay, taking quite a lot of teacher training, teachers getting to grips with what's expected, okay, building an understanding and working with each other. I mean, I notice here in California, okay, because there are new tests based on these new standards, all of a sudden people are kind of waking up and saying, hey, what does this mean? Okay, and how is it going to be different? What does it mean for my kid? And it's going to go on for another 10 years or so, I think, before it's really well embedded.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking today with Jonathan Osborne about the next generation science standards and some of the difficulties around that.
So why, you said that the prior science standards weren't required, weren't mandated. What?
They were voluntary.
They were voluntary, yeah.
Math, English, those are involuntary standards. Everybody has to follow them, but the science standards, sorry, I don't buy it. I'm not going to teach it. How's that possible?
Well, they were, I mean, all federal standards are voluntary until adopted by the states, okay? So I think it's 18 states that have adopted the next generation science standards, but they've been highly influential on the standards in other states as well. The standards within states are not voluntary, as you know, because they are used as the framework for the federal assessments, which are done at the end of grade 5, grade 8, and somewhere in high school, 9 or 10. And one of the shifts, okay, in that sense is that previously in high school you could just take the test in biology and physics and just do two sciences, but now there's a greater emphasis on the new test is in all three sciences, so it's making more demands on the teaching of science in high school.
But do we test for science understanding, practices, knowledge before middle school? Like we do math and reading a lot.
The shift is the new tests that are being developed will do that. Okay? And they're going to do it in a kind of different way. I mean, if you look at the old California tests, they were very much multiple choice, mm-hmm. knowledge and understanding. Okay, now the new tests, okay, are testing practices as well and testing students' abilities to do things. Now the consequence, because it's only a 2-hour test, is that what your kid will get for that test, okay, is going to be a very small subset of everything that they have done. And the new test in California is a kind of three-stage test. There's about 40 questions which try and cover as much as they can, which gives you an individual assessment. Okay, then there are two more extended 20-minute questions, which are the performance assessment, and that's going to be based on how you did in the first 40 questions. And then there's going to be a last general performance assessment, which is just going to be random.
Random, scary.
Yeah.
So in the 20-minute question,
yeah.
I mean, how are you going to do this? Are the kids supposed to actually physically do something?
No, they can't. No, they'll get some data to analyze, okay, or they'll have to criticize some kind of model and say, what's the strengths and limitations of this model, okay.
Did you say or choose?
I'm not sure. It depends upon the design of the question. I mean, of course, the trouble is all you get released, okay, are the questions that they don't use because they weren't any good.
That's all you get to see. Oh, man.
Yeah. So I don't know why they don't make it like the driver's test. I take a series of multiple choice questions. Yeah. I need a certain percentage, and then I go in the car and drive.
Right.
Yeah, so we throw these kids into a lab and say, go do it, and someone watches. And
well, we had to do that for the advanced placement science test.
You had to do a lab.
Yeah, the teacher walked around with a clipboard and watched us do things in the lab. I don't know if they still do that. Right.
Was your posture better?
Yeah.
Sitting upright.
It was pretty scary. It was pretty intense.
Yeah. There's been a long history of testing these, and on the whole, most of the kinds of things that you're interested in, you know, can you design a decent experiment? Okay, can you analyze and interpret a set of data? You can do with a pencil and paper test, okay, and putting people under that kind of stress and worrying about whether you can plug the right things together, okay, or mix the right chemicals is not really what you're looking for.
Mm. So to your point that it's more about process and less about content, if everybody knew how to use data and analyze and show the evidence, I mean, we'd be in a lot better place.
We would hope so.
All right. Well, this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will be back with more from Jonathan Osborne talking about the next generation science standards next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Jonathan Osborne, who is a professor of science education here at Stanford. We're talking about the next generation science standards.
So I see a lot of groups, and many of them are trying to create STEM pathways, particularly for underrepresented, on the belief that this is a good profession.
Dan, right? Can you explain what a STEM pathway is for people who don't know what that means?
You do it.
Okay. Thank you.
STEM
stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so a STEM pathway is to get kids interested in professions that use STEM. Is that right?
How about STEAM?
STEAM is where you add art to it. Ta-da!
How about STEAM?
I have no idea what STEAM means with an H.
I don't either.
Did you just make that up?
I did.
Okay. Yeah, I did.
Humanities. You always need to include humanities.
Oh, I like that.
Basically, liberal arts is
then
the other
everything. Now we've just made everything.
So anyway, I want people, the goal is no longer this is what an educated citizen needs. This is an employment utility argument.
Yeah.
So the key there seems to be motivation. So do the standards say things like kids should be motivated or you can't put that in standards because that's too intrusive to say what should be telling people what they should want to do?
Yeah, that's too intrusive. You can't do that. All you can do is say, we think what we are offering is going to give kids more opportunity to be engaged in what they do. Now, why might it help them to be more engaged? Well, it's kind of people have been studying students' interest in science, and it's interest that drives them more than utility. You know, I mean, you tell them, well, you know, you do this and you can become, a medic, or you can become a computer engineer, okay, and they all kind of like think, well, yeah, that's 10 years down the road, I'm not going to make it on that basis. okay, is this stuff interesting? And do I come into the class and get engaged? Well, what kinds of things engage them? Well, the phenomena engage them in some senses. And we got kind of some interesting work on that. You know, a student of mine's been looking at it, particularly with young girls. And there's a big problem at the moment with women going into physical sciences and engineering. What kinds of things engage them? Opportunities to collaborate and work together, which is quite important. Okay, that makes a big difference to them. Another thing that makes a big difference is is the element of choice. Okay, giving students an element of autonomy about what they do, even if it's the kind of small things in terms of design and experiment, how they put together a PowerPoint, that kind of thing helps to engage them. Okay, and what turns them off, okay, is just treating them to a long exposition of lots of different elements and forcing them through the scientific landscape.
Right.
Okay, because they just get tired and turn off.
Well, I know, because I actually asked my son about this last night, because I really thought he would like chemistry because he loves cooking.
Yeah.
And he didn't like chemistry. And he said, it's just a lot of memorization and listening to lectures. And I think Brooke said to us, who's a colleague of ours, she just remembers memorizing the periodic table. I mean, that's just
so if I can just return a little bit, why can't the standard say kids should end up being motivated? Is this because I always wonder, standards are sort of telling me what we want society to become through the process of education. Its goal is to basically inculcate people. And we're not allowed to say, but we want to leave the fantasy in there that the kids have choice. Why don't?
Well, they do have choices. You know, if there's a sense of, well, you know, do we use this design or that design? You know, the different ways. It's these small elements of choice. Okay, in that sense. They don't say they can be motivated because that applies to all subjects. Okay, I mean, it's kind of implicit hope. Okay, anybody puts together standards. Okay, wants to communicate. You know, why is this so important that we're going to make all kids learn it? Okay, what is it that makes it some of the best that's worth knowing? Okay, why is this on the curriculum rather than financial literacy in that sense? And a good set of standards communicates that. Okay, has the set of standards succeeded in part? Okay, I think it's an improvement on the previous ones. But I still don't think it quite gets there in that sense. You know, what I want to say to people about science is these are ideas that have changed the way we think about the world in that sense.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're talking with Jonathan Osborne about how to make science awesome for kids. I actually thought that example was pretty cool. Even if teachers would just do that, that's something that I care about as a kid. Why do I look like my mom or my dad, or why don't I have this trait that they have? I just feel like it's been delivered in such a dull, monotonous way.
Sorry, I stopped listening. So let's talk about instruction.
Yeah.
So teachers of science have a tough problem because they want students to engage in the practices of scientists, arguing from evidence, building theories, trying to deduce what if this theory is true, what should I see in the world?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the kids have incredibly low knowledge.
Yeah.
So scientists, you know, when they're engaging their thing, they have a tremendous amount of content knowledge to help them do all this kind of reasoning and thinking. So how do we design authentic science tasks for people who don't have any knowledge?
Well, I think I'd start from the point of view that I think people do have knowledge. Okay, they do come into classroom. People do think about the world. They do have ideas about the world. Most of the common sense world's about the idea, unfortunately, okay, you get it wrong in that sense.
Okay. This is the why don't we fall off in Australia.
Right, yeah, in that sense, okay. So it's about engaging. In my own kind of personal view about this is it's about engaging in a kind of, look, you tell me how you see it, okay, I'm going to tell you my story about how I see it. And the kind of point I like to make is, you know, all science has... I'm really struck by an interview with an artist about what she thought was good science. And she said, well, good science is like good art. It's either awesome, okay, or it's disturbing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, for instance, that you have as many bacteria or more bacteria in your mouth than there are people on this planet, that's
Ew.
Think of that next time you kiss somebody.
Which one is that?
You have more bacteria in
your
mouth.
No, is that awesome or horrifying?
That would be horrifying to me. Probably awesome to you. Horrifying to me.
I kissed my dog yesterday.
See? And I rest my case.
Yeah.
But, so it's an interesting move. It's basically to present something that's counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And then sort of try and make the case for it.
Yeah, that's right. And to take the kind of ordinary and sort of say, well, you know, how do I make it engaging? Yeah. Let's take physics, for instance. Okay, we all have to teach things like, physics teach things like pulleys or levers. Okay, and even I've looked at it and thought, well, this is pretty boring stuff. When I've got to teach it, these ideas of things like mechanical advantage come along. But really the interesting question with a pulley is, how come with this pulley I can lift something which is 2 or 3 times my weight?
Yeah.
Okay, then it turns into something which is interesting. So it's doing that kind of shift.
Interesting.
So if you're a parent at home and you want to kind of get your kid excited about science, what's the best way to do it then?
Don't take them to a college lecture.
Okay, I think that's clear.
I think you being enthusiastic about it helps a lot, okay? Mm. You look at a lot of the people who go into science, they've got something in their background, a parent who was interested in science, okay, or a parent who worked in science, okay, or if you work in science, take them to work so they can see what you can do. You know, just take an interest in the world around you, whether it's nature, okay, living things, okay, in that sense, and encourage that kind of curiosity and passion in that way. And then there's all kinds of other things you can do. You can go to science centers, okay, you can send them on summer camps in that kind of way.
So I'm a parent, and I've got my kid at the museum.
Yeah.
And it's some sort of science hands-on museum, and the kid runs from 20 seconds to 20 seconds.
Yeah.
So as the parent, what should I say to my kid when they're doing some pendulum activity? Should I say, why do you think this happens? Or what do you think would happen if? Or
I think what do you think would happen if is the great thing.
What if question.
You know, what if we made this pull twice as hard, okay, or whatever, added an extra weight, okay? And sometimes it's just some of the things are like one of my favorite ones is the kind of awesome pretty ones. Okay, and there's the Science Museum in London has this cloud chamber, okay, and you can see these tracks being produced by radioactive particles, and you don't know where they're going to come from, and they come at random, okay, and there's kind of some of them go shung like that, and some of them go slowly across like that. It's just fascinating to sit and watch it. Okay, just enjoy that, you know.
I think that's the key, right? It's curiosity, it's enjoyment, it's either the awesome or the disgusting. But either way, you're going to get a kid excited. I think that's really good advice. Thank you, Jonathan, for coming, and thank all of you for listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, and on SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.